All right, let me give you the 4 points that we covered last week on this handout very quickly, and then we'll pick it up right where we left off so we can kind of hammer through the rest of this outline here tonight. So we said, number one, planning for the future is a sign of wisdom and maturity. Number two, saving is necessary for the short term. And number three, investing is important for the long term. And number four, which is where we left off last week and we'll pick up here tonight, patience is required to build wealth. Patience is required to build wealth. Let's look at these scriptures one more time. Proverbs 21:5, the thoughts of the diligent tend only to plenteousness, but of everyone that is hasty, only to want. Ecclesiastes 7:8, better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof. And the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Proverbs 28:20, a faithful man shall abound with blessings, but he that maketh haste to be rich shall not be innocent. And Proverbs 13:11, wealth gotten by vanity shall be diminished, but he that gathereth by labor shall increase. So we left off last week with showing the video of my coworker and the tragic story where he got a message from WhatsApp, and it was someone who offered to help him invest in cryptocurrency. And he put over $220,000 into an app that was a clone of a legitimate crypto trading app. So it wasn't real, and it was one source where he wanted to get rich quick. And sometimes when our brain is triggered to think we're going to be a millionaire and we can, in a very short period of time, make a lot of money instead of through slow, patient work, planning, and investing, it leaves us open and vulnerable to that sort of thing and to falling prey for get-rich-quick schemes. One of the things we said earlier in the study is that a very high percentage, the majority of professional athletes, actually run out of money within a pretty short amount of time, 2 to 7 years, depending on the sport, that they retire. And part of the reason is they get a good income, but they may not have had a good financial education with how to handle that income. So we said last week, not to be too stereotypical, but the guy who lives in a trailer park that always has, and then he wins $2 million from the lottery, a lot of the times they spend all that and run out of that money and don't handle it wisely because they've never been used to building good habits that come with a slow and steady approach to work and a balanced approach to building wealth. Clinton Portis was a running back in the NFL for the Denver Broncos and the Washington Redskins, and he earned over $40 million in his career. But he took that money and was trying to invest in other things, and his business partner stole his money and he filed for bankruptcy. Likewise, Antoine Walker was a basketball player for the Boston Celtics, and in his career, he earned $108 million, yet he too ended up filing for bankruptcy and running completely out of money after being involved in schemes to grow his wealth, but he was involved with people who took advantage of them. So all of us should take responsibility for our own money. And I think some of those people, like the athletes who have been taken advantage of and ran out of money, kind of had the idea, well, I've got a guy who takes care of that for me. I've got a friend who takes care of my money. But it's important for us to be involved with our own money and to know what's going on. So I think we mentioned last week that day traders lose money 80% of the time. A day trader is someone who jumps into the stock market and tries to guess whether or not it's going to go up or down. And day by day, they try to make trades on different stocks. 80% of those people lose money because it's really hard to guess what the stock market is going to do in a day or two. But over the long haul, the statistics have shown that it's a good investment that slowly goes up. Forbes ran an article saying 97% of day traders lose their money within 2 years. So in other words, if you start with a nest egg and you try to guess the timing of the market and buy and sell and make trades, you may do well for a little while, but statistically, nearly 100% of the time, if you stay in it for a full 2 years trying to do that, you're going to lose your money. And with the stock market in particular, we're just going to say a couple of other things tonight that, as I said, are historical facts. And one reason to consider why a thing like that is a good investment for us to do with our money in the long term to try and grow a portfolio of wealth, not in the short term to try and guess what's going to happen tomorrow. So a lot of different times, the market has gone through what they call a crash. After September 11th, the world was panicking and they shut down where you couldn't make any trades for 4 days, if I remember what I read about that correctly. Then after that, when they reopened, the market went way down. And a lot of people pulled their money out and said, well, it's time to panic. All my money's going to be lost. But within a matter of months, it built back to where it was, and then it continued to go up. So they say when you track over time what the stock market has done, every time that there's been a major crash where they've charted 11 different events that have caused the market to go down rapidly and people to start panicking and pulling their money out, 7 out of the 11 times, the stock market has fully recovered in less than a year. And that's using the S&P 500 kind of as a guide marker for what the rest of the market has done widely, where if you were invested in something similar to the S&P 500, that's what your investments would have done. So, Ronnie, would you mind closing that door for me if that's okay? And if you don't mind, that noise just helps me a little bit to block that out with this big room and some of the noise coming in. So I wanted to explain, too, that the S&P 500, when you buy a share of it, you're actually buying a share in 500 different companies. So when you buy in that or in a stock market portfolio that's spread out between hundreds or even thousands of companies, you are buying something that is diversified. So if you have all your eggs in one basket, which I'm getting ahead of myself, but if you have all your eggs in one basket or you're impatient and you're trying to pull your money out and put it back in and guess which individual stock is going to do well, the statistics say you don't fare very well. But when you invest in something that is diversified and you're patient over time, the history of it, for our country anyway, is that it has continued to go up and up at a rate of roughly 10%, which is why you can run the numbers through a compound interest calculator like we did last week, that if you invest roughly $100 a week, something like $500 a month, if you get 6% over the course of your career, it's over $1 million. If you get 8 or 10, it's somewhere between $1 million and $3 million. And we'll talk about statistics in just a minute, how a lot of people have built wealth that way. But again, I'm not just talking about that one thing. I'm using that as an example to talk about the biblical principle that it's wise to be patient when we're trying to build wealth. So when you look at the stock market itself, the S&P 500 as a measuring stick and other groups of funds that perform similarly, it's called a roller coaster that eventually keeps going up. So you look at the chart and you'll see big dips, but then the dip comes back and it keeps going higher. And at the end of the chart, it's way up here when it started here. But what happens in the middle is it does a whole lot of up and down. So when you invest that way, you have to be patient and allow it time to go down and then to come back up. You would have never had less in the stock market a decade later if you measured at least that far out in advance. And I think it was under the Jimmy Carter into the Ronald Reagan era, they called it a lost decade, where the stock market was basically a wash, basically broke even, but the next decade was a 20% growth rate. So it averaged out again to 10%, even though it took a couple of decades to get there. So if you had your nest egg in it 10 years later, you would have more in the nest egg pretty much no matter when. Even if you started at the beginning of a bad decade, it doesn't really do worse than zero. So historically, you will always win if you sit there and keep your money there and let it go up. So the long run of investing is being patient to let it grow. And when you get a 6% return rate, you double what you have in your nest egg in 12 years. When you have an 8% rate of return, it takes you 9 years to double the nest egg. And if you get 10%, it doubles in 7 years. So a lot of the times the people who have invested in that from age 20 to 30 to 40 to 50, it goes very slowly. But then between age 50 and 57, it might go from $600,000 to $1.2 million if the numbers were coming back good on that rate of return. So I think the wise financial advice, if you are investing in the stock market through your employer or through accounts outside of it, is you take the strategy that it's not an air fryer or an Instapot, it's a crock pot. And when you're making a crock pot recipe, you close the lid and you let it cook slow and steady, and you don't go move it around and open it and look at it all the time. If you were to look at your investment portfolio, whether it's through work or one outside of it, what if you looked at that every single morning, it will drive you crazy. It's better off to really not even look. Otherwise, just measure year by year, see if you're missing something or if you're in the wrong type of program. But when it's down on Monday and the news talks about, I think just last week, right? We had a crash in the stock market, a mini decline. If you were to panic and pull all of it out at once, you would miss out on all of the future gains that are going to slowly come back over time if it performs the way that it always has historically. So some people have asked the question, and I myself wonder sometimes, what happens if we hit a wall where all of our bad financial policy that has been enacted by the U.S. government catches up to us at once? And we see that happen in countries historically, where Germany had their economy completely broken after World War I. The world was very harsh on them. They stepped in and said, you're going to pay all the penalties. Their economy went to nothing when they lost the war. And the reports were it would take like a barrel full of cash to buy a meal. So picture that we have such a bad financial crash that it, instead of $10 to buy a McDonald's meal, it takes a wheelbarrow full of $10 bills. Is that type of thing possible in our future? I certainly think that it's possible, but we can't guess the future. We can't know the future. So the question is, if we had a nest egg and we were headed for that kind of a crash, could we survive that type of an apocalyptic crash? Maybe we can, maybe we can't. Maybe you want to have a bunch of water bottles in your basement. Not that we have basements in Texas, but guns and ammo and batteries. And maybe some of that thing is wise, things may be wise to do as a hedge against a time where we hit a bump. But it's also possible you could have those things, and if everything really went that bad, you could still be in a lot of hurt. So I guess what I'm trying to tell you tonight, very simply by bringing that up, is to say there's a lot of times when I'm teaching you scripture, and this class, these lessons specifically, are scriptural principles, okay? So it's not a law, but it's a principle. It's things to think about. And then sometimes I'll tell you, here's my thoughts. Here's what I would do, but God may lead you a different way. My basic thought is that if there is a crash coming someday, we can't really know if it's going to or when, we might as well take advantage of these good opportunities in our American capitalistic society to make money until that comes, because that day may never come at all. So I think there's a really good chance in our lifetime that we can have the opportunity that others have always had, which is to work really hard. Maybe we buy property, maybe we invest in the stock market or other things like that. And that if everything continues at a somewhat similar rate through the next 30 years, as it has for the history of the country, we might as well take advantage of the opportunities to grow and invest and own things and work hard and do as well as we can while God has given us that opportunity. So some people take the investment strategy of the closer you get to retirement, you should pull more of it out of volatile investments or things that go up and down. Some people look at the stock market and they say the closer you are to retirement, you pull some of your money out of that, you put it into bonds, you put it into other things like that that aren't as risky. People like Dave Ramsey, who I've mentioned, I listen to quite a bit. He says if your nest egg is big enough, just leave it in what you've always invested in. And chances are, even if it were to go down for several years, it will probably slowly come back up, and you should be fine. Warren Buffett says if you want to invest, just buy the S&P 500 and don't worry about anything else. Dave Ramsey says talk to a financial advisor and buy a portfolio that's even bigger and more diversified than the S&P 500. And if you do that, that's a diversified investment. So even amongst billionaires and wealthy people, there's disagreements as to exactly how you go about it. But I think we would do well to be wise to do something to plan for our future, so long as we're giving, so long as we're enjoying what God has given us and we're taking care of our family and we're not living by fear or being too much of a tightwad. I don't think it's a wrong thing to invest our money and pray that it would grow for the future if we're doing wise, diversified investments. So the theory from people who know more about it than I do, like Dave Ramsey, is that if the stock market were to completely crash and go to zero and never come back, and your money would all be gone forever that you had in there, it would essentially mean our entire economy and dollar is shot anyway, and the whole thing is starting over. So if it all has to start over, you can make another plan. But in the meanwhile, when it's not all crashed to zero, the stock market is a good opportunity historically for working men and women to put their money in and to slowly let it grow. People talk about buying gold bars, and you know, some people even say, well, my husband has, you know, $200,000 cash buried in the backyard, and he has gold bars under his bed, and you know, you can do whatever you want, but gold bars historically aren't as good of an investment as things like real estate and like the stock market. And if tomorrow you couldn't buy anything because the whole economy shut down, you probably wouldn't be able to take a gold bar down to Walmart and buy things with it. But I guess it's a more sophisticated strategy than I would even know for someone to have a net worth that's so big that if the American dollar crashed, they could have enough gold to trade to other currency, that they could shift their whole life somewhere else and live there. Things like that are probably beyond us. So it's not a bad thing to diversify and plan. What if we hit really hard times? What if the grocery store was out of food for a week? That's not bad to think about if you want to plan for stuff like that, because we saw it happen during COVID. But my personal philosophy, if you were to ask me my opinion, I'd say go ahead, work your jobs, invest in the stock market, and plan that if it doesn't all come crashing down in our life and we have to start over anyway, it could be a really good opportunity for us and a wise investment to plan for our retirement or for when we're older, and maybe we can help our kids out and take the burden off of them or whatever the case may be. If we're able to take advantage of wise investments and patiently plan for the future. So when you invest, I think you should leave it in your investment, not look to pull it out, not worry all the time about the ups and downs, but write it off as money that you spent. Like I said, at the end of a horrible decade, it basically came out to being a savings account that was a 0% rate of return. But the chance that it goes to zero forever and never comes back is probably tied to the chances that our entire economy turns to vapor anyway, which I don't spend a lot of time worrying about, even though I'm very aware these things can happen and have happened in nations before. I guess my philosophy is do the best we can to plan for whatever, but I'm going to trust the Lord and I'm going to take advantage of the economy we do have that historically has been one of the best in world history. So during COVID, the government ran a program where they said, we'll make a special provision that you can go into your 401k or your IRA, your retirement accounts, and pull all of it out, and you won't have to pay a penalty. When usually you have to get to 59 years old or something like that before you can pull money out without a penalty, because it's structured that way to encourage us to leave it in there and let it grow till we need it in our elderly years. But the government said, oh, there's a virus. We're going to force everybody to stay home and not be able to work. And so we're going to do things to help you, like spend trillions of dollars in stimulus checks, which made everybody happy for a little bit. But you know what that did? We talked about it before. It caused inflation. You can't print dollars and throw them around all the economy without the goods we're purchasing slowly going up in cost. And the other thing the government did is they said, we'll help you by letting you pull money out of your retirement accounts and not have to pay a penalty. But for those people who did that, they would have lost out on their compound interest. And if the money that was pulled out during COVID was pulled out due to panic, all you had to do was leave it there for less than a year and it came right back up. So some people say, well, the stock market's down 10% in the last month. I lost all this money. but you didn't actually lose the money unless you've taken it out of there. If you leave it there, historically it comes right back, which is what it did after COVID. So my personal advice is if you have a nest egg like that that's slowly growing, don't pull it out. Don't take a loan against it. Keep investing at small rates and leave it alone. That protects your compound interest year over year, which is really what gives it a chance to grow when you get a little bit later on in your life. Let me take a drink of water here. I hope everybody's okay, all right? I'm gonna try to power through these next two pages, give us a chance to answer questions and still be done on time. One more side note here is that Dave Ramsey also tells people that a whole life insurance policy is not a great investment. So we should have life insurance if we have assets and if we have family members involved. If you have a family or a spouse that counts on you at least somewhat to pay the bills, it's a very wise thing to have a life insurance policy that if one of you die, there's a payment that will help to make up for the deficit that is left by them being taken away. And again, in a family where both people work, there's an income that's counted on. In a family where the wife stays home with a bunch of kids, she's counting on the husband to make money, but he's also counting on her for childcare. So it's good to have a life insurance wise financially. It's good to have a life insurance policy for the husband and the wife so that if something happens to either one of you, there's a payment there to replace that, at least in the short term, to help take care of the children and the bills and the assets that you've built up to that point in time. So a whole life insurance policy says you pay into this your whole life, and when you die, there's something like a guaranteed $1 million payout, which sounds good to some people because they think no matter what happens to me, my family will get $1 million even if I live to be old. Dave Ramsey advises against that because whole life insurance is on average 20 times more expensive per month than term life insurance. So term life insurance is where I go to the life insurance company and say, I'm 34 years old. I only want to be insured till age 60. And they'll look and say, okay, we think it's a decent bet. You won't die till then, at least on a large scale. Most of the people your age and in your physical condition will live to be 60. So the payment for that type of a life insurance term is 20 times cheaper than whole life. And he says the reason it's better to not pay for the super more expensive is if you just run the math equations of how much cheaper term life insurance is and invest the difference in these other long-term investments like your 401k, your IRA type things, you actually grow that nest egg a whole lot bigger. And if you're 70 years old and you've been investing for a long time and you have a net worth of over $1 million, you've paid off whatever property you're living in, you probably don't need life insurance in the same way you would if you're younger and you have family members that are younger who are counting on you. Multiple online sources like NerdWallet say that investing in a whole life insurance policy gets you a return rate of 1 to 3.5% each year. So it's better to invest the difference you would save by buying term in something like the stock market. That's the philosophy there. I have random things. I'm just trying to check off my list and get through this. And hopefully next week will be a little bit more of a Bible study like it usually is. And we're almost done with this study. But I think the practical things are important for us to consider as well. So Dave Ramsey's company, Ramsey Solutions, did a study of millionaires where they surveyed 10,000 people who had a net worth of over $1 million. And again, having a net worth of over $1 million, being a millionaire technically, doesn't mean you make $1 million every year. It means you take the equity in your house, the cash you have in savings, whatever equity you might have, your retirement accounts, and that all adds up to over $1 million, then you're a millionaire. So they surveyed 10,000 people who had reached that millionaire status at a certain point in life, and they said, here are 10 habits of the 10,000 millionaires that we surveyed. They were avid readers. They understood the principle of delayed gratification. They were wise in how they chose and built their relationships. They avoided debt. They lived off of a budget that they made and planned to live off of. They lived below their means and kept a little bit in an emergency fund in case there were unexpected expenses. They, by percentage, most of them said they avoided luxury vehicles and they kept their vehicles for the long term. And then another characteristic was that they invested in their employer-offered retirement plan. And then the last two is they looked for multiple ways to earn money rather than just one job that paid them money throughout their life. And number 10, they were givers. They were generous with the money they made. Isn't it interesting how that following God's principles and God's ways and building good habits really pays off for our benefit and our blessing in the long run? You would think, well, what does being an avid reader and studying all the time have to do with making money? What does giving money away have to do with building a net worth of $1 million? Well, those are good habits. The reading builds our education, and the giving shows that our heart is generous and in the right place. And I think that God blesses those types of habits. So the people they surveyed who were near the end of their life that had a net worth of $1 million didn't statistically have car payments for very long. And again, run the numbers through a calculator. If you take the average car payment and invest it in the stock market over your career, again, it's literally the difference of being a millionaire or not. They paid off their house eventually. They invested in their 401ks and their Roth IRAs. The top five occupations of the 10,000 people they surveyed that made it to millionaire status were engineers, accountants, business executives, and attorneys. Now that's four. And doctors were not on the list. Sadly, they say that sometimes, not always, but sometimes the doctors took so long to start making good money and had so much debt that by the time they started making the big money, they wanted to enjoy the big lifestyle. So sometimes doctors aren't as wealthy as you'd think they are, even though they make an extremely high wage. But you know what was number three on the list of people that they surveyed? It was teachers. And you would think, how are teachers showing up in the top three of a survey of 10,000 millionaires, that being their occupation? And it's because they took advantage of the investment program that was offered by the employer, and over a long career, they were able to see their investments grow and retire from being a teacher as a millionaire. So people will complain about our economy, and there's a lot of complaints that I have too about the government and the way things are run and how I wish it was better. But the bottom line is, if we sit back and make excuses and say we can never get ahead, we're ignoring the truth of these statistics that in America, if we work really hard and are wise in how we resource it, we have a great opportunity to live a comfortable lifestyle and to build wealth compared to what most of the world has been able to do over the course of human history. We have a great blessing and opportunity in front of us if we will seek to be wise. So let me move to number five. I think I was going to mention the terminology a 401k and a Roth IRA are similar in their structure, where you pay into the stock market, your retirement account, you hold it till you're 59 years old or whatever it is before you start taking distributions. And the difference is a Roth IRA is better because the money grows tax-free and you can make penalty-free withdrawals when you get to retirement and start pulling it out. With the 401k, if all your money grows up, I heard a call from a guy who had $7 million in all these different accounts that were all 401ks. And when he went to take the money out, he was going to have to pay $2.5 million in taxes to convert it to the Roth IRA. When if it's invested in the Roth, it's better for tax purposes. And it's named after the senator whose last name was Roth that helped pass that legislation decades ago. And sometimes like your employer match into the fund has to go to a 401k, and it's better to get free employer money towards your retirement than none at all. But when you're investing yourself, it's better to go with the Roth IRA over the 401k. I feel like this is a weird Bible study. I've taught very few Bible studies like this in my life. That doesn't feel like a Bible study tonight, but I'm going to power through this. We're talking about practical applications of financial wisdom based off of biblical principles. So what else can we invest in? It's not just the stock market. There's different things we can invest in. An investment is by definition something that goes up in value over time. So an RV you buy goes down in value over time. A house you buy or acreage you buy goes up in value over time. So one is for consumption, for enjoyment. Nothing wrong with that if we can afford it, but it's not an investment unless it's something that slowly grows over time. A business can be an investment, investing in somebody else's business or having your own, but there is a difference too with the way that things are structured, the debt we take on or the risk we take. One little example is I used to watch that show on ABC, Shark Tank, where Mark Cuban and the other millionaires, anybody ever saw an episode of that, they would hear pitches from small business owners and then they would invest in their company. So one guy came in and he said, I want to start a lobster roll truck in New England somewhere. So a food truck that would make lobster rolls and sell it on the side of the street. That one actually did extremely well. They made a lot of money, but there's a difference in being the guy who wants to start the lobster roll truck and giving away percentages of your business and taking on debt versus the person who has a lot of money and who is investing in that guy. He has money to lose. So what I'm saying is it could be a good investment for you to start a business. But if you think you're good at making lobster rolls and you've never really tried it before and you haven't talked to a lot of people who've ran a food truck and you borrow $40,000, $50,000 to go start a lobster roll truck, maybe you'll do great. But maybe you'll not do great, and there'll be things you didn't expect or life events that make you have to try something different, and now you've got a massive loan to have that you'll have to pay back, or they're going to sue you to try and recoup the money you paid in. So all of these things may be different for different people, but an investment could be a tiny house that you have in your backyard that you're allowed to rent out to other people. Probably can't do that in Collin County, but you could rent a room somewhere or own a rental house or an Airbnb. Somebody said, was talking about investments, and they said you could buy a chicken farm, and that would be part of your investment portfolio. So I don't know if anybody here tonight would buy a chicken farm, but I'm just saying hypothetically, you can acquire assets like that, that over time grow in value, where maybe somebody bought a chicken farm and paid somebody to run it for them, and then they sold it 20 years later, and they bought it for this much, and then they sold it for a ton more money. Things like that can be investments. Historically, in America, the stock market and real estate are investments that have done very well. A lot of people get excited about the idea of owning rental properties and being a landlord, and I think that could be a really good investment if you're able to handle it financially and if it's a wise decision for you. If you borrow too much money to buy all these rental properties, you might have people who don't pay rent or they sit empty. Then you're in a situation where whatever gains you may be making, you're trying to cover. But if you could own a rental house and own it for 20 years and then sell it and you could afford to do it without a lot of debt and risk, that could be a very good investment. If you have a job where you're close to a pension, which not many jobs have anymore, that's part of your investment. Your equity in your house, your social security for you, or you may have a spouse that is only 2 years away from qualifying for social security. Maybe they could work and pay a little bit more in so that they could draw some out. Not that I count on that being there in 30 years because that's already almost broke anyway, but I'm just saying a lot of people have been able to take advantage of those types of things. Number five, the time to start doing a wise thing is now. The time to start doing a wise thing is now. So part of bringing up investing for the future is that it's frustrating if you haven't done it so far to think about lost time and wish that you could get it back. But just because you may have lost some time up to this point does not mean that there isn't still time for you to start and for you to plan. Maybe you only have 20 years instead of 40. It's still better to start now than to do nothing at all. Couple of verses from Proverbs 26. The slothful man saith, there is a lion in the way, a lion is in the streets. As the door turneth upon his hinges, so doth the slothful upon his bed. The slothful hideth his hand in his bosom, and it grieveth him to bring it again to his mouth. Again, the idea being he's eating, but he's too lazy to bring his hand up to his mouth to eat his food. It's comical, but it's rebuking laziness. The sluggard is wiser in his own conceit than seven men that can render a reason. So some people, as I've said, have been hyper-spiritual and have said, oh, there's no need to invest and plan for my future because Jesus is coming back. Well, maybe he is, but maybe if Jesus doesn't come back in your lifetime, like he hasn't come back so far, you'll be glad you wisely planned for the future. Some people say, well, $1 million 30 years from now won't be that much anyway. When you consider inflation, $1 million won't be what $1 million is now. That's true, but I bet $1 million 30 years from now is still going to be better than not having anything 30 years from now, so we might as well plan and do the best we could. When we see the market crashes or all these things, someone could say, well, I'm glad I didn't have any money in there because I heard it went down last month. But again, statistically, if that person had put it in and left it in, they would have gotten ahead in the long term by being patient and letting it grow. So the time to start doing a wise thing is now. Number six, wise counsel and a good plan are always a requirement of success. So your brother-in-law calls you up and says, I got a hot tip. Take all your savings and put it in this one stock or bet it on this horse down at the horse race track. I think they still have those around. I've never been before. You do that, it's in Grand Prairie, right? I used to hear people talk about that. So what's that? That's gambling. That's not wise. That's taking somebody's counsel who may or may not know what they're talking about. Proverbs says, where no counsel is, the people fall, but in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. Then Proverbs 19, hear counsel and receive instruction that thou mayest be wise in thy latter end. There are many devices in a man's heart. Nevertheless, the counsel of the Lord, that shall stand. So how do we grow? I said the millionaires said that they read a lot of different books. That's good for our brain. We grow and we learn by asking questions and emulating successful people. We don't know it all, so it's good to learn from other people. I think it's dangerous in any area of life to be one man's disciple. That could apply to ministry work. Well, I like this pastor and I only do whatever he says. Well, maybe he has a lot of good ideas, but it's better principally to listen to 10 different pastors and teachers so you get a wide and broad perspective. And a lot of times when you're just following one person and one person only, you're not thinking for yourself. You're just being their disciple and doing what they say instead of thinking things through yourself. So we can learn by listening. And listening requires not always being the one who talks. It's a wise person's characteristic to ask questions and to listen to people and to learn. One man said, I can learn something from just about everybody. The person you may dismiss and think, I don't think they know as much as me. If you get to know them slowly, they may have an area in life that they know more about than you do. And if you ask questions and learn and are humble, you can get wise counsel even from someone you wouldn't at first glance think would qualify as a counselor. So everyone has a different field of expertise. And if a pastor's good at teaching the Bible but horrible at handling money, I want to listen to somebody who's good at handling money so that I can learn from them. I'd rather have a mechanic who cusses all the time while he works in his shop that knows how to fix my car than a nice Christian who can't fix it and I take it back four times and he doesn't know what he's doing. So one pastor in Michigan was facing a lawsuit for his Christian schools. And they said, you're not allowed to run a Christian school. So they had to sue the government and they were going to go to court. And he had the option of taking a Christian group of lawyers, how do you say that, the law firm, or of taking a secular one. And one pastor told him, you should not take that secular law firm and let them represent you because the Bible says we're not to walk in the counsel of the ungodly. So he said, I heard his advice. I prayed about it. I looked at it. I talked to several people. And then I decided to hire the secular law firm. Because I wasn't just going to do whatever they said. They were working for me, and I felt they had more expertise in this case. So it was actually wiser to hire the secular law firm to represent our Christian schools so we'd have a better chance of winning in court and not getting shut down. So what am I saying? You can learn from a lot of different people. You can study finances from a lot of different people. Yes, I believe wise financial advice is rooted in the Bible, but I'm just saying be willing to consider counsel from a wide range of sources and weigh it carefully. That's how we learn. That's how we grow. Two more points here quickly tonight. Number seven, diversity is a reasonable approach to investing. I'm still not 100% sure if the meaning of these verses are what I've read, but most people seem to think that Ecclesiastes 11, 1 and 2 is talking sort of about giving, but really it's talking about investing and managing what you have. Verse 1, cast thy bread upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days. The idea probably being don't always be afraid and just hold on to what you have. If you give it away in God's economy, it comes back to you in blessings. If you invest it wisely in a financial setting, it comes back to you and blesses you. Give a portion to seven and also to eight, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. And again, but while Ecclesiastes is kind of difficult, most people I tried to check the meaning of this verse that gave commentary said they think it does indeed have to do with dividing up your assets between seven or eight different places instead of keeping it all in one place so that if something bad happens, you have a better chance of surviving it. Let me see. I think some of these things I might be repeating myself. I don't want to talk too much more about the stock market other than to say we don't know what the future will do. And there's the saying past performance is not a guarantee of future performance. But over the course of 100 years or more, it can be a pretty good indicator that that is a sound bet. And again, if you invest in a wide portfolio of mutual funds or the S&P 500 within the stock market, you're not just invested in one thing. You're invested in hundreds or thousands of companies at once, the more the better, so that if some of them do poorly, the others can do good. So when you buy shares in something like that, it's by definition a diversified investment because you're buying in a bunch of companies at once. And that's called hedging your bets and not putting all your eggs in one basket. So if you want to buy cryptocurrency and you put all of your money into Bitcoin, that's a fairly new entity that's volatile, that's up and down. And whatever you think of what it's going to do, the downside of throwing all of your money into Bitcoin is that it's a single entity. So if Bitcoin does bad, you lose all your money. But if you're spread out between hundreds of companies, of many different concepts, different companies, you have a much better chance of surviving some ups and some downs. Maybe cryptocurrency will make you really rich. Maybe you'll go broke. Right now, nobody really knows for sure. I told you before, I heard a call on a financial show from a man who said, my father-in-law is healthy enough to work, but he won't work. He wants me to take care of him. And the reason he ran out of money is he took his entire nest egg of $300,000-$400,000 and put it into oil. Oil's a good investment sometimes, but sometimes they don't find the oil. Sometimes the government restricts drilling for oil. And sometimes during COVID, when the government mandates nobody travel, oil went to negative and they would have paid you a few dollars to drive down to Houston and pick up a tanker full of oil because they had too much down there that they couldn't even handle it. So throwing all of your money, all of your assets into one thing is by definition not a wise way to handle our investments. Traditionally, Apple stock would have been really good. If you could have had a crystal ball and put all your money into Apple stock when the company was founded and left it there, you would have made a ton of money. But the point is we don't have a crystal ball. So if we tried to guess at Apple stock, there's just as good of a chance we would have guessed at the wrong thing and would have lost all of our money. So it's much wiser to be diversified. Mark Cuban, who sold the Mavericks last year, made his money because he had a tech company. And in the early days, they called it the dot-com bubble. So all these investors threw tons of money at these technology companies when the internet itself was something new, but the technology companies actually weren't making that much revenue. So when those companies went out of business, a lot of people who were super heavily invested in the companies like the ones that Mark Cuban owned lost a ton of money. It was called the dot-com bubble in the stock market, where it grew, and then a lot of people lost a lot of money because they weren't diversified enough. They thought the tech companies were going to make them rich. So the interesting thing about Mark Cuban is he sold his company to Yahoo, who I think overpaid for his website, whatever his company was. And then Mark Cuban took a guess that in the next 6 months, the dot-com bubble was going to burst. He shorted the stocks, and he was right. And he made all of his money. He bought the Mavericks for $285 million in the late 90s, I think, and then sold it last year for over $3 billion. So his story is the less common one. He took gambles. He was right on the timing. But timing is very hard to guess, so it's better to be patient and be diversified with our money spread around in multiple things so that if one does poorly, we can still do well. Several financial teachers say a wise rule is don't have any more than 10% of your nest egg in one thing. So you think Bitcoin is going to make you a millionaire, you're convinced, okay, but don't put more than 10% of your money into it. Still keep your nest egg that's diversified, and then if you can afford it, you're basically taking a risk that you understand it. And you should invest in things that you understand, but single entities, you should be careful to not put all of your money in. Most teachers say not more than 10%. If we take out debt for investing, that's not a very good idea either. Guys, I'm right at the end here, okay? Let me see. This is another random question people ask about investing in the stock market or investing at all, is what if companies I invest in are immoral? In other words, what if I invest in a company to grow my money and that company supports liberal policies like paying for their employees' abortions or something like that? I think as Christians, you have to follow your conscience, do whatever research that you would want to do. But I also know there's a lot of people that are in positions of power who invest in a blind trust. And it's kind of like that through work sometimes. Unless you do a ton of research, you're trusting people to manage that fund for you, and you don't have all of the details in front of you. So the way that I look at things is that a boycott of a company who's doing something wrong can be effective if it's very focused and in limited doses. For example, Target came out and announced back in 2015 or 16, our bathrooms are open to whoever wants to go wherever. If you're a man, you go in the ladies' bathroom anytime you want to. We stand for inclusion. Well, certain family associations said, let's boycott Target. And they did. And I didn't go to Target for a long time. And Target stocked their gains. Their stock prices plummeted, is what I'm trying to say. So that was very focused, where even Walmart and other companies, they may have had different policies. They said, let's not go out and announce when no one's asking if men are allowed to use the women's bathroom. Let's just kind of not do that. So that was helpful. But I guess the basic way I look at it is if we're building a playground out back for our kids, and Home Depot is down the road, and Home Depot is the closest, and the best quality, and the best price, and we can take the Lord's money and go to Home Depot and buy the boards and the screws and the drills and build something here that's a blessing to the children of God and the growth of the church, then it's very hard for us to take responsibility for all of these companies, because most companies now are in some way or another doing something that's not great as far as their politics and what they donate to. Your employer may donate to causes that aren't great or that you wouldn't like. And again, you have to follow your conscience. You shouldn't participate in sin. But my basic idea is let's go ahead and buy from Home Depot and build the playground for the glory of God. And if Home Depot takes the money that I paid for a fair price for this product and does something displeasing to God with it, then that's really on them, not on me, because it's very hard for me to keep up with what every company is doing anyway, especially in today's society. So if you're investing in this giant portfolio and you don't know whether any of those companies are doing anything that could be considered wrong, then I don't think God holds you too responsible. Number eight, being wealthy is not a sin. A good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children. And the wealth of the sinner is laid up for the just. Again, these are general principles, not a promise to be true in every situation. honor the Lord with thy substance and with the first fruits of all thine increase. So shall thy barns be filled with plenty, and thy presses shall burst out with new wine. There is treasure to be desired and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man spendeth it up. So again, it's not a sin to grow our net worth. King David was a wealthy man. Joseph of Arimathea, who believed in Jesus and volunteered to give him the tomb for a burial place, was a wealthy man. King Solomon was extremely wealthy. Job had a vast number of assets that he owned, was very wealthy for that time. And God was pleased with him and his character. In the book of Acts, property owners sold their properties to support persecuted Christians. But if they hadn't had property to sell, they wouldn't have been able to give of their assets in that time of extreme needs. Last verses here tonight, 1 Timothy 6. Charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who giveth us richly all things to enjoy. They that do good, that be rich in good works, that they be ready to distribute, willing to communicate. So don't love your riches, be willing to share and give to good causes, and by that, laying up in store for themselves a good foundation against the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. Basically, that verse is admonishing rich people to use their riches to lay up rewards for themselves on the day of judgment when we see Christ. But there is no condemnation for being wealthy or for growing it if we do it through ethical means, if we also give, and if we don't love our money. And it's wrong to be prejudicial against poor people, but it's also wrong to have an anti-rich bias where we're thinking down on people and being jealous of them just because they're rich. We think, oh, you're not godly. You should have given all your riches away. Well, maybe they're giving away a good percentage, same as you are, and God is pleased to let them be blessed with more things. A lot of the times that attitude comes down to being covetous, jealous, lustful, or making comparisons, and none of that is wise in the plan of God. If you build a good nest egg the right way, you can still give it away when you die. You can give it away as you go, or you can use it to enjoy. Think of your kids and their future or your own future and make a plan for it. This is not a sin in the eyes of God, so long as we are doing both. I'm at 8:02 and I'm kind of tired of talking. I have 10 study questions down here that I was going to scroll by one up on the screen. We can do that if you want, or we can just be dismissed, or what do y'all think? Let's vote on it. Who wants to read the study questions? Nobody. All right, let's read them on our own and let me know if you have questions later, okay? Maybe we'll open next week by going over them if you want to take a look at it, okay? Let's be dismissed with a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you. I pray that this financial study would be a blessing just to give us things to think about and to plan for as we look to the future. Bless everyone who came into church tonight. In Jesus' name, amen.